I'm sure a number of you, I know a number of you have already had a chance to meet our guest this week. Reed Hunt graciously agreed to be our visiting distinguished interdisciplinary practitioner for 2006-07. And if you saw, if you caught his lecture, you can still see it on the website yesterday on China and the challenge to American entrepreneurship. The influence of economics and even cultural analysis on his thinking about these problems is pretty obvious. And you probably all know this, but Reed is a graduate of Yale College and Yale Law School. We discovered he was a mere first-year student when Dean Nancy Rogers was a third-year student, and of course, not talking to first-year students. But Reed went on to clerk on the Fourth Circuit, practiced law with Latham & Watkins, both in LA and DC, and is best known, I suppose, in the public world for his leadership of the Federal Communications Commission from 1993 to 1997, which coincided with the enactment of the Telecommunications Act of 1996, easily the most important piece of telecommunications legislation of the previous 60 years. Reed is now doing a variety of things. He's an advisor, he's with McKinsey & Company, he's on the board of Intel, he's worked with a lot of startups, and occasionally we try to write op-eds together, and we've even published one or two. But he is, he thinks widely, but I didn't want to, even though he wants to think about very big things, I couldn't resist insisting when he came here, he'd tell us what the heck is going on with telecommunications reform. There's somebody who says the internet's made up of tubes, and for some reason he's not getting the bill through Congress, and who the heck knows what's going on. So I figured if anybody could decode this for us, it would be Reed Hunt. So Reed knows he's supposed to talk for 20, 25 minutes, and then we get after him with questions. Reed Hunt.
Hello, folks. Well, I've had a great visit here, and after this lunch it comes to an end as I get driven, I hope, to the airport, I guess on how lunch goes, and then I fly off to Chicago and whatnot. But this is the part that I was really looking forward to, because now I get to go to law school and don't have any grades. What I thought that I would do is maximize my pleasure here by presenting to you not anything remotely like an answer, but what is at least one way of asking some of the questions. What specifically is the answer to Peter's question is that nothing is happening at the moment with respect to telecommunications reform. All the people in Congress are checking their email logs right now, or erasing them as rapidly as they can, and probably within a day or two, it would be my guess, the Speaker of the House will step down. And if we really did have a rule of law, there'd be some people, that would be getting indicted, other than poor Patricia Dunn. So nothing is happening. But interestingly, even without all of the scandal and the fact that Congress is, ground to a halt, it probably was going to be the case that the two-year-old congressional effort to have the Telecom Act of 2006 replace the Telecom Act of 1996, that effort was probably going to fail anyhow, even without the scandal. And the reason it was going to fail is because, in my judgment, the political explanation is that more or less the new economy fought the old economy to a political standstill. Meaning, more specifically, Yahoo, eBay, and Google hire a whole bunch of lobbyists and a bunch of what they call astroturf firms, if you know the phrase. You know, instead of grassroots, it's pseudo grassroots, and mounted in the current conventional way a political effort against the Telecom Act of 2006 as it was being drafted, the way that it was being drafted. There have been a couple of things like this since we had a new economy, since we had these internet firms, but not anything of this magnitude ever before. And what was it then that the Congress was mobilized around trying to do? What was it, what is it that is causing a standstill? Well, what they were mobilized behind trying to do was to deliver, I believe, was to deliver deregulation and or more profit-making activities, primarily to the telephone companies. And I think you can help us later, but I think they were pretty much indifferent to the cable industry over the last couple of years. You might say why, but the answer is that from the telephone company perspective, the cable industry bears a resemblance to creative destruction entrepreneurship attack against the voice market. So that is the goal by the bulls in Congress that were driving this, really, I think, was to figure out how to use law to solve what the telephone industry today believes is its biggest problem. And its biggest problem from a financial perspective is that they don't have much to show in terms of return to shareholders for, what would you say, it's nearly a decade, isn't it? Is that about right? Speaking of the telephone side now, not cable story is more interesting and more volatile. Right? The reason why the telephone industry doesn't have much to show in terms of shareholder return is that its revenue is rooted in fixed line networks delivering voice and data networks that are mobile and that provide access to the internet those are the trends of the last decade. So that it hasn't been possible in business competition for these businesses rooted in fixed line networks that provide voice to obtain any clear path to growth. Now, what they have done, and the day now is the consolidation has boiled down to Verizon and to SBC, now known as AT&T. What they have done is they have developed and or acquired major wireless arms, cellular companies, that 10 years ago they had only the faint replica of what they have today. But those companies are primarily significant in the same geographic regions as the fixed line networks are. So Verizon Cellular, while it offers service all across the country, its customer base and its revenue overwhelmingly is concentrated where Verizon, the wire-based company, is. And the new AT&T, the cellular version, Singular, is overwhelmingly concentrated where the fixed-line assets are. So that doesn't indicate that they've really committed to a growth story, because while they are offering service on a national level, again, they're very geographically focused. And to illustrate the point of the lack of presence in what we will call the internet or new economy dimension of it, when AT&T enrolls a broadband customer in competition with cable, which is usually offering broadband to the same person, that's fair, isn't it? Often, I think cable would justly say, "Do you all know each other? Does everybody know you?"
I don't think so.
Oh, you should say who you are, because I keep pointing to you. I just realized.
I'm Jonathan McGee. I'm an 89 grad in law school. Executive director of cable.
So we actually have somebody that knows something here
that
can keep me in check. When they're offering in competition against cable, AT&T... I think almost all of its geographic markets has is its default position that you are, your front screen is Yahoo. If you enroll as a broadband subscriber to AT&T. And what does that tell us? AT&T could not create an internet space that was as attractive or even remotely as attractive as Yahoo did. They cannot create the content that is in that space, which is a variety of new media content, streaming video, access to music, communities, websites, postings. They tried and they gave up. AT&T actually pays Yahoo a certain amount of money, which I know but can't reveal, per subscriber for the ability to offer this. It's just it's a little indicator of the absence of these old line telephone companies from a vibrant, profit-making, growth-oriented presence in the new economy. So when the head of AT&T, Ed Whitaker, struck his deal with Bell South, which hasn't quite yet been completely approved, but certainly will be, maybe even like today, when he announced it, which was close to a year ago, he said words to the following effect. Well, when we own all these pipes, wires, last mile access connections, the actual physical facilities that connect the broadband to the house, however you want to describe it, he said, when we own all these conduits, of course we're not going to let everybody else use them for free. We're going to charge based on the content. So if not maybe Yahoo, but if Google created a website that consisted of a host of video clips that you could search, and then you could say, I really like that, I want to download that. What Whitaker was saying is, well, you want to use the pipe, it's going to be like a toll highway, I'm going to charge you. And when he said that, it kind of caught the attention of Google and others. And everybody said, wait a minute, you know, differential pricing based on, you know, commercial arrangements that could, you know, be of a variety of different kinds. They said, that is not the open, free access to the internet that we used to have. We don't know how we got that open, free access to the internet before. We don't know where it came from. It was just an accident. Larry Lessig at Stanford wrote a book that some of you may know called Code, which now is Code 2.0. And in that book, at page 187, if I remember correctly, he says, someone in the government, by accident, created the open internet in the 1990s. And I emailed Larry and said, it was me, and it wasn't an accident. It may or may not have been a good idea, but we had a bunch of lawyers, God forbid, and some economists, and we sat in a room and decided that that was what the way it was going to be. And I said, you know, it's personally immensely dispiriting to have, you know, you as this great guru write that it's an accident. But worse than that, if you all think it's an accident, how in the world do you think you're going to be able to maintain, you know, this paradigm, if you like it, in the future, since apparently you think it just comes out of the sky, you know, it's like hail or something, you know? Well, they don't think it's an accident over the last 12 months. Now they think they get all the credit because they hired the right lobbyists. But be all that as it may, that's what happened. They did hire a bunch of lobbyists, and they went in and they fought the pro-telecom draft legislation, pro-telephone company draft legislation, to a standstill. But it's a completely unresolved matter. Yes?
Can you just tell us the moment where the people think that
that
happened?
The decision?
Yeah.
In the 90s? It's more than one thing. It's probably about seven or eight things. But there's only, but I can give you three that matter. It was immensely important to reiterate a fairly musty decision from the 80s in the context of the internet. The musty decision from the 80s was when businesses create data networks, which in the 80s primarily was for financial services businesses that would contract with MCI to create things that look today like the Bloomberg screen that you see in the airport. the FCC declared in a fit of pro-business behavior, which is not that unusual, they said, this has nothing to do with the regular telephone network. It's completely exempt from state regulation, and MCI and the others can go out and install these things in the businesses, and we're not going to treat this as if it were telephony, even though it's obviously communications. So they created a classification for that. What we needed to do in the 90s was say, we adopt the same classification, we're going to apply it to the internet. But when we did it, we knew, not because we were farsighted, but because a whole bunch of people came in and told us, you're going to be putting the proverbial camel's nose under the tent, because this internet is going to allow people eventually to use its software protocols to replicate voice, which is known as voice over the internet. So we knew that what they didn't know in the 90s, which is that by saying that it was unregulated and couldn't be regulated by the state commissions, we knew that we were undermining the traditional scheme. And we also knew that by undermining it, we were creating the possibility of truly devastating, disruptive pricing for entrepreneurs like Skype against the telephone companies. That was number one. Number two, we said that the principle of reciprocal compensation could continue as to internet providers. Reciprocal compensation means this. You have a rural telephone company, I have a, you're in Iowa, rural telephone company, I have a telephone company in Chicago. When I call you, I send you money. When one of your customers calls me, you send me money. We reciprocate. And it is balanced according to the number of calls. So if more people in Chicago call to Iowa than Iowans call into Chicago, which generally is true because the businesses in Chicago emanate the calls, whereas there aren't that many businesses in Iowa that emanate the calls to Chicago. What happens is it's a transfer of money through these phone lines from the one company to the other. Now, it's not that big in most situations, but it's very, very big in a few situations. Nobody calls, everybody calls pizza parlors, they never call you. People call funeral parlors, they never call you. People call internet service providers, they never call you. The first two cases are skimpy. The third case got to be very, very huge in a really, really big hurry. Because in the 90s, that's how you logged on. You dialed up, and your machine, or you sometimes yourself, dialed to the internet service provider. And when you did that, because of the sneaky FCC issuing an obscure and virtually, obviously by Larry, unnoticed order, we created a regime in which literally more than $1 billion a year was transferred for incumbent telephone companies to no-name startups such as AOL. So that was, it was totally intentional. A crass, admitted subsidy of the new economy out of the revenue pool of the old economy. With only one point that I would make about it, which is it was either going to go that way or it was going to go the other way. There was no, we couldn't figure out what a midpoint was, what neutrality would be, so we said it should go that way. And third and last that I'll bore you with is this. We created the following regime. The user could use us in our homes, we could use the telephone line and connect it to our computer and have that provide internet access, and the telephone company could not say no to that. You had the right to do that, and the phone company could not say no to that. Those that know telephone law know that many battles were fought over many, many years, the famous Carter phone case, about whether or not people could attach the telephone line to equipment of their own choice. But the complexity here was it wasn't just the equipment, but the fact that the equipment would use the telephone line to send bits of information across that line, and we said, well, that doesn't make any difference. You can still connect it to your computer. And then on the other side, the internet service provider, the company with all these servers and all the information out there, we gave them the right that exists for all businesses to lease telephone lines at the going rate, at a market price that the phone company could not alter so as to drive them out of business. Meaning, when they figured out that AOL was in fact creating this business on their physical platform, had they had the freedom to do so, you would have expected that Verizon would have said, why don't we charge Steve Case $1 million per line and see how well he does then? So we said, well, you can't do that. In other words, we didn't have one decision where we said we're going to favor this industry. We had a bunch of decisions in which we said the ecosystem is going to have the following paradigm, one in which Steve Case is going to have the lowest conceivable cost basis for going into the business of providing internet service. And so will anyone else. No licenses, any number of firms. There were more than 5,000 mom-and-pop companies created in the United States to provide internet service, of which three emerged as the dominant companies in a utterly hands-off marketplace competition from the government perspective, except that all 5,000 were put in a favorable ecosystem as opposed to a disfavorable ecosystem. That is why internet service in the United States had the lowest retail price of any such service of any country in the world from the minute that the internet came into being until today. A, really, really low cost basis. B, 5,000 providers competing like crazy. So in other countries, this did not happen. In Japan, it did not happen. In Germany, it did not happen. In Korea, it did not happen. In all these other countries, every other government said, whatever the heck this thing is, if it's growing, we want the telephone company to have a big piece of it. Deutsche Telekom is the biggest internet service provider in Germany. Or, we don't know if it's going to be growing, but at least we don't want them undercut. So there's a very fundamental, you know, bias. Now, to make a very long story, too short and sweet to be completely accurate, the telephone companies have been unhappy and mad about this since those decisions. And so this Congress was going to write a law and is still bent, assuming that anything like the same Congress is returned after November, still bent on reshaping the landscape in some particular manner that is usually regarded as, in the following jargon, making sure that the network isn't neutral anymore. Or to put another way, Yahoo, eBay, and all those folks say, we want the network to be neutral, we want network neutrality. So what I'm going to race through in just a couple of minutes are some slides that intend to ask you to take a look with me in the time that we have at this question. And I invite you to have any stance about economics, political science, or law that you want. And I will just say to you at the front end, Greg Rostin, who's an economist who used to work with me at the FCC and now is the co-director of the Stanford Institute for Economic Policy Research, he and I have been trying to write a white paper about network neutrality, and for a year now we haven't been able to figure out exactly what to say. So I could really use the help. This is where we start, and I'm going to, you know, if anyone's interested, I mean, I'll leave these things, but I'm not asking you to spend a lot of time on even on the substance. Question one is, what the heck is the information sector? And the only point of this slide is, boy, it is, in fact, a great deal. It is a very large number of markets that are almost always regarded as distinct. But in fact, they're not distinct. Every one of these markets, in some way or another, you know, gets its bits from, stores its bits off of, sends its bits into the great communications network. Every executive in almost, but not all, of every one of these businesses will tell you that they're not regulated. And every one of them, if pressed, will then say, well, yeah, the regulation has an enormous impact on me, but it doesn't really regulate me. Actually, every one of them is immensely regulated in ways that they don't like to tell Wall Street. And then there's the non-market way of looking at it, and what value should we give that, right? So what would be our plan here? You know, what do we want to even be talking about? Well, before we figure out what we want to be talking about, let's just note something about the rise and fall of these companies. And the only real point here, I guess you've grasped it already, is From that $2 billion of value that these three companies had before they did their IPOs, all of them were in that neighborhood, to today, there's been a lot of volatility, and the trough was staggering. But $200 billion more is a lot of money. And what's the cable industry's market cap, you know, in the aggregate? My guess is that it's about $100 billion for the entire cable industry. And the telephone industry is probably about $200-$250 billion in market cap. So, not holding me to the numbers because I didn't refresh my recollection, but generally just accepting this. Their chips now are about as big as the other guy's chips, which is an amazing thing to have had occur in just 10 years. And it's not an accident that that's why they were able to block this legislation, right? I mean, there's something to the size of the army, the market cap army that you bring, you know, to these fights. On a global level, these are the kind of growth rates that leave the telephone companies somewhere between despair and disappointment, usually verging more on despair, because the growth rates are staggering, and this is what they don't really share in. You might say they share in broadband, but the problem with broadband is they're only charging for the actual physical connection. They're not charging for any of the content, and they don't really yet have a working business model to charge for any of the content. And every broadband line that AT&T installs on a net present value, they lose about $3 for it. They lose about $3 for it. The only reason they're installing them at all is because they hope they'll make it up later by being able to charge for the content, the very thing that the CEO blurted out, you know, before closing his deal, which was a mistake. And also because if they don't take this loss and get these customers, your industry is going to get them, and then they'll be totally foreclosed from having a future of any kind. Louder? They have to yes, there's a lot of labor involved in, even when they don't have to roll the truck, in just talking to the, you know, annoying customer on the telephone. Plus, the stuff never works, and somebody also always has to come out to your house eventually anyhow. Plus, they actually do have to put in CapEx in the ground. And I did give you a net present value number. They do, you know, show something on the revenue line. But depending on whether you believe, and I do tend generally to believe, the way they allocate costs, given the way they allocate costs, they end up with a negative net present value. The other big, huge, enormous trend is the growth of mobility. And the reason that Morgan Stanley originally did this is to show the following, that third column over mobile phone to internet user ratio. In the United States, we have more internet users than mobile phones. Everywhere else, the opposite. Meaning, we had a huge installed base of fixed line phones, and that's how people first got on the internet. These other countries don't have that huge installed base of fixed line phones, so they first buy a mobile phone, and so the mobile phone becomes the device to get on the internet. That was forced by the exigencies of circumstance in the other countries, but now here those same technologies, mobile access to the internet, are becoming very accessible and very affordable. Another threat to anyone whose business model primarily depends on the fixed line connectivity as the way to hold the customer. And while we have had a lot of consolidation in mobile, the short version is, if you're the telephone company, you're the only person, you have 99% market share in your region for fixed line voice. And if that customer moves to being a mobile voice person, then your market share goes, at best, from a 99 to 40. So you've lost.
So what is the purpose then, as we think about the rule of law? This is a straw man idea of the purpose of the rule of law. There might be some other way to say this, but I don't know, and I put it up here to ask you later when I stop talking to tell me what should be the right way to describe the purpose of the rule of law. But I would just say one thing. Certainly, speaking from my experience as a regulator, you can't have very many bullet points or numbers and expect them to remember them, those regulator people. Three is probably like one too many. Michael Porter tells us the reason to increase the standard of living for all citizens. I think his actual phrase is to have a high and rising standard of living. This is in Competitive Advantage of Nations, 1990. And then he goes on to say in the next paragraph that that's driven overwhelmingly by productivity gains. He wrote this book with a vivid awareness of the Japanese firm versus American firm competition of the 1980s. And I still think it's a very serviceable explanation of purpose. I would point out that this and that are completely absent from the statement of purpose of the telecom reform law that we were talking about. You get a search party to look for these phrases even in the shadow form, and you can't find them. What they didn't want to say is we're trying to help the telcos, but that was their motive. This purpose too is absolutely not reflected in the draft legislation in any way that I was able to find, but this is in fact, I think, at least a stab at what animates people. And you do see weird, quirky telecom language in all the legislation that in some way captures some of these things. And probably the most particular example is that ever since the 1930s, all the legislation always says we want these services to be universal. We want them to involve everyone. The universal?
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's, yes. When I was in the government, I had a meeting with all these economists at Stanford, and I was saying, oh gosh, I'm told all the time to worry about bottlenecks, and Bill Baxter said, don't worry about bottlenecks. That's the purpose of competition, to have someone seize it. And I think that his too early death is a really, really big loss for a whole bunch of reasons. But one of them is for the ability to formulate very crisp and accurate statements about very complex things, and also to show that you can be a pretty darn courageous guy and have a good time in government. So Baxter in the Reagan administration is the guy that broke up AT&T, and which is not normally the kind of thing you would have thought the Reagan administration was dedicated to, and it never would have happened but for the fact that everyone higher ranking than him on the totem pole owned AT&T stock. And in that ancient and quaint era, it actually stopped them from ruling on the matter. Hard to believe that would happen today. So even the Attorney General said, I can't talk to you because I own AT&T stock, and Baxter said, let me get this straight. I'm a lawyer, I'm an economist, I think he's a lawyer. Yeah, a lawyer and an economist, and I'm not a politician, and no politician can talk to me about this matter. They said, unfortunately, that's the way it is. So he said, well, I'm breaking this thing up. And he stopped suing IBM. Neither of which two things would he ever have been able to do had he not been empowered by that conflict of interest. But this is really a way to talk, a way, I'm not saying it's the best way, to talk about this debate between Google, eBay, and Yahoo, and the telcos. And I don't know the answer to these questions. That's why they have question marks after them. The only thing I want to tell you about Williamson is when I was the book review editor of the Law Journal, I edited one of his pieces. And he called me up and told me that he never wanted me to change any word of his ever,
or ever say anything negative about any of his words. And I said, I don't understand the way that these words are lined up. He said, that was my problem. And if you like his style, it's not my fault. Yeah, you know, and if don't get the credit, and if you don't like his style, it's not my fault. But Williamson has that good phrase. Now, Tim Bresnahan was the economist at the Department of Justice who crafted the antitrust case. And I always thought that his way of thinking about antitrust was the clearest way to think about information economy antitrust problems. And I think to this day that it would be useful to either erase the Sherman Act and the Clayton Act, or to persuade all the judges to just forget about them, which, of course, as you know, they have the power to do, and to talk about antitrust the way that Tim talks about it, which is that those are the three tests that you should use in analyzing anti-competitive activity. And so this is in a paper of his that Google will pretty easily help you find. And if you applied those principles, you would get extremely interesting outcomes. You would, for example, not care very much about market share. It wouldn't bother you if somebody was a 100% monopolist, if all three of those conditions also existed. So if we went down this path, we'd be doing another great thing that Baxter did. We'd be doing it again in a different way. He invented the HHI, and we didn't invent the HHI index, but he put it into the operations of the antitrust division. And what we would do, at least in information markets, is we wouldn't do that anymore, and we would put in these kinds of standards, and we would get why would it matter? Because you get very different outcomes. For example, you might say, we don't mind the telephone company having a monopoly in connectivity, but we do mind if they use it to foreclose entry by someone else, and we do mind if they integrate it with other parts of the technological platform, but we don't mind if the cable company and the telephone company merge in the same market, provided that these conditions are met. You get very different outcomes.
Could you explain divided technical leadership?
A divided technical leadership means, for example, the software is Microsoft, the hardware is Intel, as opposed to the software and hardware is Wintel. So if you, and I'm on the Intel board, so I'm just purely a hypothetical, if, for example, you felt that Microsoft and Intel were agreeing on the platform in a manner that foreclosed somebody else from introducing competing software, you'd be very upset, right? But if you didn't feel that was the case, you wouldn't care very much about Microsoft having a 95% market share. And it wasn't the size of Microsoft's market share that Bresnahan thought was the basis for the lawsuit. So if you took this approach, you'd end up looking at, and this is the engineer's way of describing the network in the aggregate, you'd look at those factors with respect to each of these layers. I'm just going to skip this. Because you'd then be saying, well, if I want something open, i.e. I want something divided, I want to have some indirect entry capability with respect to some entry point, I got to then define what it is. This is a top-down look at a network, looking at it, all the piece parts that way. The other is a what they would refer to as a logical look at the network, you know, building up the way the network operates in a in the computer sense of a logical network. And you'd compare it to, for example, other industries and analyze how open or closed they are. And then you'd get ultimately to the question of, well, how do we, if open is the language we want to use in this ideal Telecom Reform Act of 2007 with a whole new Congress that wants to take a fresh look because somebody's going to talk to them about it in some sensible way, you'd start saying, well, when you say network neutrality, you really mean open. And this is the end for me, and I've gone on too long, I apologize. But you'd start saying, well, I need to sort out what these categories are. in terms of open. This is a straw man for sorting out the categories. The ones that I want to illustrate, bring out just to illustrate by way of conclusion, and not to talk about all of them, is, first of all, speed. So speed literally means, you know, can you download it in a hurry? Peter and I were talking the other night. Suppose that you had a business that was a website that consisted of video. And suppose that you did really well, and then you reached a contract with, let's pick on cable for this heck of it, with Comcast. What's the local provider? Time Warner. Time Warner's a good example. Let's suppose that Time Warner had a whole bunch of video, and they decided that when you click on the Time Warner website to download the Time Warner movies, they came to you just like that. They came to you so that you could watch them in real time unfold, or they came to you 20 times faster if you wanted to store them on your laptop because you were going to go on the movie, on the airplane. But Universal has its own movies, and when you click on the Universal website, they don't even tell you, but it just is all like really slow. And you're the user, and Time Warner didn't tell you, so you say, there's something wrong with the way Universal makes movies. They look like Charlie Chaplin. You know, everybody's going like that. That's what speed means, right? But speed means other things too, but it means that. And it means that it's easily possible with respect to any of these parameters, or at least most of these parameters, to have differential treatment if you own the pipe that in fact completely alters the value proposition of the content or of the user experience, if we want to expand the word content. It's completely technically possible. So, how do you feel about that? You know, how do we think about our point of view? Is that great because that will mean that there's a way for Time Warner to avoid the trap of the telephone companies, which is they didn't know how to make money out of content? Or do we feel, well, we got to think of an antitrust policy that says that's wrong because it seems to cut things off? Or do we go back to the social stuff and say, even if it might be okay economically, it greatly disturbs us to have it be that this medium that links all of us could be altered in that particular manner? Suppose Time Warner said, let's give an example, suppose Time Warner said whenever you click on the Hillary Clinton icon, it comes across really, really well, but when you click on the John McCain icon, you know, he looks like he's 95 years old. Well, they can do that, technically. It is not tricky, and it is extremely hard for the users to sort out to define distinctions. What kind of rules do we need to have, or should we have no rules? That's the speed point that I wanted to bring out. But every one of these different categories has got immense capability to, and this is my summary statement, immense capability to alter the terms of competition, the allocation of welfare gains, and the way that the society perceives and works across the network. Every one of these categories. And I'm not claiming I got all the right categories. The PS, the last one, is the dot there that says point of view. So today, now correct me if I'm wrong, I always say this because I try to get a rise out of people, but I might not be right. I'm pretty sure that if I raise the money to knock on the door of Time Warner and buy an advertisement that says, I think that the CEO of Time Warner is a really bad guy, and I think that people ought to rise up and protest his actions. I actually like Dick Parsons and don't think that, but suppose that I thought that. I'm pretty sure that Time Warner is well within its rights if it says, we don't like that ad, we don't want to carry it. Am I right about that? No, no matter how much I offer, there's no way I can buy access to that if it displeases Time Warner. Is that not right? So that same rule is true for all of broadband. Just want to make the point because meaning is always imparted by difference. That is not true of the telephone line. I can pick up the telephone line and I can call Peter and I can say, Ed Whitaker is a really great guy, and you can say back to me, I think he's the son of a bitch.
and it is against the law for the telephone company to do anything about it. So we have one rule for the old medium, which is a completely individual free speech type rule, and we have the exact opposite rule in place right now for the new medium, which is a completely network operator-centric rule as opposed to a user-centric rule. And this is my conclusion, my real conclusion. It just absolutely mystifies me that you can't even have a discussion on that topic in Washington. People go like, well, what's the deal with that? What's wrong with that? You know? And of course, what they're thinking is that the cable company is like Arthur Sulzberger, i.e., you know, it's the printing press. But is that really what we think it's like? Maybe it's like Arthur Sulzberger. Maybe it's like the real newspaper business today, which is there's a monopoly in 99% of all the cities, and they don't have to carry your ads. What's that case? The Florida case?
Miami
Herald and
Tornillo.
Well, that's it. Those are the... I didn't have any answers.
Peter did admit. So one thing is, one of the ways to say antitrust laws is there is a competition. And that's been left out in the 2006 telecom. They got exactly that. And they're writing the lease, monopolizing the streams to protect competitors. And they've just forgotten every first principle of the
Yep.
Here's the part that you didn't talk about, that's the lead argument for the paralysis, which is how are we going to pay for the big pipes and how are we going to pay for the last mile? And if you put on, pulling apart from the hard industry, like the regulatory rules for your 14 categories and open it, how do you pay for the last mile? Especially when one of the easiest ways to pay for the last mile.
Yeah.
And so how can we tell that story? This may be a goal, but how do you match that up with sort of diffusing the technology?
Yeah. Response?
Yeah, because that's their...
I'm tempted to say the following. I don't care. I'm like big time tempted to say, I kind of really don't care. You know, that's like saying, you know, how do I keep, you know, some newspaper in business? I don't really care.
Same for North Dakota, Montana, so they cost a lot to get it out.
So then I say, well, the difference, what is the difference between the willingness to pay collectively for all Americans and the cost of broadband? Not what is the cost, what is the difference between the willingness to pay and the cost? This is a debatable number, but I have spent a lot of time asking people that should be able to answer it what the answer is. It's about the cost of 6 months in Iraq. And then it's done.
So we could have the full network of big connections to people, and it's not that big a society.
You know, it just isn't. You could say many things about it, like I'm a free market person, I don't like that, or I don't like subsidies, or I don't think the government should pay for what people will pay for. You can say anything you want, but I don't think you can say that it is a meaningful number against any denominator that you could come up with. It's not even a meaningful number against the total revenues of the telephone business. It's not a meaningful number against the CapEx that is already spent by conduit providers in the country. It just... So that's the second thing, I think, right? Here's the third thing, I think. The telephone industry is losing $3 of net present value on every line they install. I understand why, from a shareholder perspective, they don't like it. But the reason that it is that way is because your industry invested $95 billion in CapEx from 1993 to 1999 to build a network that offers broadband. The last I looked, it was like 85% of all homes. Now, no other country in the world has a duopoly. Everyone else, basically, except Belgium, everyone else has a monopoly in the conduit. This is a lucky break from a game theory perspective. if we don't pay any attention to the telephone company shareholders and don't do anything at all, they still have to lose $3 a line on the telephone side to install these networks to compete against cable. And if they don't do it, and cable ends up with 75% of the market, I go back to point one, what do I care? What do I care if it's 50-50 between those two industries, 75-25, 90-10, 10-90, what do I care? Don't I care about all these other things more than that?
My question would be, trying to evaluate whether we should have Congress step in and create net neutrality or not, and make a judgment on it. We'd be trying to figure out, well, what would happen if it is just the status quo, there are no net neutrality rules in place? How would it all shake out? Would it be a free for all where everybody starts tailoring different, you know, paying you more?
This is a great question. This is where Greg Rossum and I can't figure out what to write. I mean, we can't figure it out on many topics, but this is probably the biggest hole in our thinking. We don't feel that we have good foresight, and I think you're sort of asking me, what is foresight, right? What would happen? But I generally think the following is likely, not that I'm comfortable committing it to writing. First, I think overall you're going to have the welfare gain get transferred from users to network operators. The money will go the other way. Second, the dot-coms, the internets, the new economy people, however I'm committed to label them, they are using technology in market after market, in industry after industry, to undercut existing pricing structures. So, for example, that's what they've done in the record industry. That's what they're doing with respect to pay video. That's what they're doing in the software industry. You can't make a buck the way you used to in most of these industries. You could say that's good, you could say that's bad, but you're not going to get the same effect if the platform becomes pricey or limited in its use by those firms. So that's probably the best example, the one I was most glaring at, I shouldn't have left out, you know, what Google is doing to the advertising industry. Well, Google is doing that because Google is getting an immense free ride on the network. And by having that incredibly low cost base for reaching everyone, they're undercutting the existing advertising industry across the board. I mean, the advertising industry in the United States is bigger than any one of the industries that we've talked about. But, you know, as you know, you cannot find a less efficient form of spending money than advertising as it's existed. Yeah.
So the way that Google did the ads on its main search page was different from Yahoo and Google in terms of segregating the ads so it didn't, the searches themselves weren't paid to produce a higher result. Getting with a higher up and brain.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that would be sort of neutral in the sense that we're not going to allow the ads to be sucked into the actual search process where it's more democratically determined by how popular the page is, etc. So that norm seems to have also, if I'm not mistaken, seeped into the other search engines as far as not allowing. I may be wrong, but not allowing the payment to get your link higher up on the search.
Right.
And so that might be an example where there's no law in place that says you can't do this, but by whatever norm that is created, it's worked out, I think, relatively consistent with how users might expect that their searches are increasing. I guess that goes back to my main question. Is it possible that even if you don't have that neutrality, we're were going to have some ISP that would act similar to how Google Energy with respect to
probably. I'm not disagreeing. I'm just saying, you know, the AT&T view would be, but Google and all of those folks will pay us per ad they charge. Today is not imposed on them. A nickel, a dollar, you know, whatever the market will bear. And if the cable industry decides to price in a coordinated manner, I'm not saying against Sherman One, but just saying if they decide to follow, there won't be any way to avoid it. And so, in effect, you'll be doing the same thing that occurs today, which is, you know, it's pretty expensive to buy the ad in the newspaper because you got to buy all that paper, too, you know, to have your ad go on top of. So that thing would operate that way.
This is great and fascinating. There's a lot to talk about. I guess the one thing on your common carrier point, I've always thought that it's at least of some relevance that we had a post office clause in the Constitution before we had a First Amendment, with the notion being that the government has the affirmative authority to create an information highway system. Doesn't matter what technology it is, but
it's interesting.
Yeah, you know, that's embedded in the structure. I tried to write a paper for my own telecom person with magic when I was in law school. But I've always thought,
you're selling it.
Yeah,
good. I'm glad it's.
I like it.
20 years later, it's getting some traction. You know, whether Congress will choose to exercise that or not, you know, is another matter. But at least I think, you know, I guess I share that. I've never understood why. The cable industry, no offense, or have said we've got a First Amendment right to control content on our in our bottleneck or on our lines. I mean, it seems to me that you know, anybody who operates the roadway of the information superhighway is doing so at Congress's pleasure. That we do have both the First Amendment and a postal clause, and it seems to me that therefore Congress in the exercise of its authority to structure the information highway has to have rules like no content discrimination of the kind that you describe, but those rules can be imposed on what would be either the licensee by virtue of actual regulation or the de facto licensee by virtue of the marketplace. So I don't know if that's the other thoughts I had picked up on one of the themes, which is, you know, apart from the marketplace, what about the culture, particularly the political culture? And we did ask, what if Hillary's picture, gets treated differently than the Kane picture? And two specific things occurred to me as in the conversation. One was, it's fascinating to me that it appears that you're suggesting that a Republican-controlled Congress would likely favor old industry over new industry, telephone over new providers. And yet, yesterday on Terry Gross on NPR, I'm listening to this new book by Mark Halpern of ABC News, and I'm a good guy at the Washington Post, who's written a book on The Way to Win in 08. And the thesis of that book is that the Republican Party has learned how to use the internet and the new technologies in terms of attack ads, campaigning.
Right, they're very good at it.
And it was the old media that was the so-called liberal bias. And so it just seemed like a little bit of a schizophrenia or dichotomy in terms of Republican Congress favors exactly the institutions that supposedly are the most beneficial to Democratic candidates, and it's the new media that's becoming more successful for the public. And
it's a good point. I can make a comment on that, and I should say this so as not to unintentionally leave a false impression. The telephone company lobbying is the most powerful of any lobbying that I know of, with the possible exception of the insurance industry, for the reason that they have employees everywhere, absolutely everywhere, and they have huge numbers of employees, and they have immense cash flow, and since they've been regulated since, you know, the since 1913 at the state level, they have armies of lobbyists at the state level, and so the telephone industry just does a really, really great job. They have this, because this is a Republican Congress, they are immensely influential with the Republicans, but they were not uninfluential with the Democratic Congress. And when John Dingell of Michigan, Democrat, ran the Commerce Committee, he did everything Ameritech told him to do all the time. So it's not, they're not, as an industry, it's not partisan. Now, nevertheless, it is true that historically the cable industry, consisting of a bunch of upstarts, was tended to be more aligned with, you know, irritating, annoying Democrats in its early years in the 80s and 90s. And whether it's cultural or whether it's a coincidence, some of the leading executives in the cable industry were card-carrying Democrats. However, they haven't really been emphasizing that for the last 10 years. So it's not that there's any ideology here. It's just with the powerful and majority people in the Senate and the House are under the sway of the telephone companies. And there's other individual stories that I won't go into, but they, you know, that's the way it sorts out.
Which I don't think imposing some sort of discriminatory pricing scheme is going to encourage or discourage competition with that. But there's just some, well, as you know, there's just some contributing physical constraints that need to be overcome. But I would just really hope that sometime in the next 10 to 15 years, we figure out some efficient way to deal with the pricing scheme, because I can't believe we're just going to build fatter and fatter pipes over the next 10 years. But there's like no reaction.
I might even agree with all that. I definitely agree with most of it. I have thought that a very good step would be to deregulate fixed line voice, meaning forget about broadband for the moment, since the alleged pressure here is the economics of the underlying fixed line voice business. You know, none of the states should regulate that. There should be differential pricing. They should be able to charge more to those, you know, who are willing to pay and directly do that. And where they have a clear need for some kind of government support to, you know, give the poor or the disabled access, you know, it can be identified as such, as opposed to instead having the following regime, everybody pays the same thing for basic phone service. That would be a useful thing to do here, because there'd be a reduction in the deadweight loss, and there'd be an increase in the amount of money that would go into the telephone industry, and then they'd have a little bit harder of a time, you know, making the terrible cry for help here. That'd be easy to do. It's intensely deregulatory, and it's just been done in California. You couldn't get them to do this in a million years, and the phone industry won't ask for it.
We should say it's at 1:15, so nobody is rude at this point if they have another engagement. But we have a few more minutes, so people want to continue talking.
The follow-up on the sort of democracy culture point is, are there laws or regulations or a regulatory policy approach that would encourage better public discourse and debate if we are concerned? I mean, one of the theses, and I don't know if I share it, but you know, here we had the political director of the Washington Post and the political director of ABC News lament that public discourse currently is not as well done as it used to be. Now, maybe that was because they had natural monopoly in the print business and in the broadcast business, and they just lament the fact that now they're under different competition. But I think there's something to the notion that, you know, there was more fact-checking of articles in print, and maybe more, you know, until Dan Rather spilled the beans, you know, better fact-checking in broadcast than there is in the Drudge Report, et cetera, et cetera. And again, we don't want necessarily too much of the heavy hand of regulation, particularly content-based. Should there be any policy that's geared towards improving discourse for the sake of democracy, or should a deregulationist approach that, you know, whatever infrastructure we get, we're going to get, and then whatever consequences that have for the way we conduct democracy is going to be, and we just have to cope with that, whatever arises.
You should answer that. What do you think?
I think I'm going to edit your draft.
No,
I think that part of the problem, this is going to give Ned a lot less than he was hoping for by way of an answer, but I mean, part of the problem, I think, is that we do treat, I mean, this is just going back to Owen Fisk's First Amendment and social structure thesis, that we treat all speakers as equal, and that we treat, in the sense that however much money they want to throw at their speech, we count that as within the First Amendment umbrella. The impact on what people get to hear is not a permissible factor in our public policy consideration. So I don't see any policy cure. I mean, I can see, you know, I think things that would be helpful would be, you know, mandatory lowest price or free advertising for political candidates, all these, but it's not going to happen because, the networks get so much money from political ads. They're never even going to broadcast the point of view that says that they shouldn't be making the money. So I, And if there were direct regulation, you would get the Buckley versus Valero response, which is that it's illegitimate under the First Amendment to regulate speech for the purpose of having a, for making some voices that would otherwise be drowned out, audible. I've never been able to sort of think myself out of that as long as Buckley versus Valero is the law. But Ned knows more about this than I do.
No. I mean, and Buckley, that part of Buckley staying the law for the foreseeable future, that's for sure. You know, one might have hoped that the internet being a much more low-cost platform would facilitate, you know, I mean, I think, you know, political discourse on the internet is more grassroots than the AstroTurf stuff that occurs. So, you know, there may be more populism of a type.
But I don't know a lot of network theory, and actually maybe the next sentence will exhaust how much network theory I know. But no matter, those students of networks have observed that even if you have a bazillion noded network, a huge percentage of the traffic always winds up going to like half a dozen nodes. Well, so, you know, there is something sort of chimerical about saying, you know, why worry about this? There are 300 million voices out on the internet when, in fact, CNN.com and, Yahoo,
Well, there was what presentation was it? This was in the last week that said that the daily cost, you know, it starts out as a tiny little thing, but now it actually has to, spend a lot of money because it needs a server capacity because it gets so much traffic. I mean, I used to think that, you know, internet speech was essentially economically free because, you know, you don't have to pay for it, like unlike a postage stamp or a telephone call or whatever. But I gather if you're actually big in the world of providing speech over the internet, it can actually get expensive because you need the server capacity.
The marginal cost of the next listener is very low, but the sunk cost can still, the servers and stuff.
I'd like to add a second sentence to the network theory to sort of take a different point on. So earlier today, there was a very low traffic blog that outed the names of at least one of the pages that apparently had contacts with Foley. And that got picked up by InstaPundit, by Glenn Reynolds, which is a much higher traffic blog. And now it's sort of outed. And one of the things that happens routinely on the internet is a very low traffic voice, very cheap, personal blog, if it gets noticed by medium traffic, it can rocket up and then spread out everywhere quickly. And in the network world, if you had to get through the three networks and they were the primary news thing, it would be much harder to get through that bottleneck. So in the end, a very large fraction of the traffic on the net might go through the small number of biggest sites, the CNN sites. Or whatever. But the possibility of an interesting tidbit catching the eyes of others and spreading is much bigger on the internet the way it exists today. And that low traffic person who gets picked up doesn't have to pay for expensive connections. So there's, for at least a lot of conversations, there's a possibility of having a cheap way into a big audience. But it's based on catching the eye. So I think it's a little more optimistic for getting diversity points out than a three networks and half an audience model.
Yeah, but push back a little bit. I mean, is it a good thing if the, I mean, as a privacy person, you know, if the pages don't want to be outed,
that's just as transparency and openness good, and the answer is, if I'm spreading your social security number, it's bad. If I'm outing you without your permission, it's bad. Right, there's a series of risks that go with it, but the broad political point about it getting out probably swamps that in a lot of places, and then maybe have specific protections around the theft and fraud.
Yeah, I think that sort of dynamic has the way you're talking about the sort of, the moment of the fate of our news and the fact-checking and sort of the ethics behind it. And there is a sort of a teeter-totter effect, sort of give and take. I mean, and that said, you know, the little guy eventually probably will be shut down, the server is, but the news will be out because the people track that.
The news will be out if there is a sexual aspect to it. you know, somebody comes up, there's a compelling site out there that explains why, you know, intelligent design is nonsense in the most compelling way possible. It's not going to be picked up. There's no money. But I didn't mean to have the last word.
No, I...
we should thank Reed for 3 days of... if I don't drive you to the airport, it's only because we want to keep you for a fortnight.
Thanks, everybody.
No, thank you. Yeah, thank you. Really great.